On the way on Sunday morning, comedian Griff Rhys-Jones, and I think New Zealanders got to know him in the 1980s, originally in the TV series he did with Mel Smith, Alas, Smith and Jones. Here they were reminiscing on the Beatles.
Do you know something? Sgt. Pepper was the first record I ever bought.
Was it? Really? Yeah.
What, you'd nicked him before now?
That's right, yeah. Yeah. Well, I was a bit of a tearaway in those days, but what days they were.
Oh, they was. The 60s. Was the days,
the 60s, I tell you, can't tell you something. The young people nowadays, they've got no idea.
No, of course they don't. They don't even know they're born, do they?
Right. Well, they weren't. They weren't born. They weren't born.
No, they didn't even know they wasn't born.
Look, nowadays there might be some good rock groups around.
Yeah,
obviously, people nowadays like listening to today's bands.
Yeah.
But can you honestly tell me, in the last 10 years, has there been anything to compare with something really great like Chirpy Chirpy Cheep Cheep?
No, there wasn't much to compare with it then. Well, no, was there? Really? No.
Oh, those were the days. Do you remember that? Swing in London?
Yeah. Where was that?
London.
Swing in London.
Yeah.
England swing like a pendulum do. Yeah.
Centre of the universe it was. Yeah. Yeah. Centre of the universe. For youth culture.
That's right.
Rock music and fashion.
Music and pop
from
music.
The King's Road in Chelsea to Carnaby Street in... just off Oxford Street.
That's right, yeah.
Oh, yeah, oh, I mean, yeah. London was the place to be.
That's right. Where were you living then?
Devon.
Since the straight comedy days, Griff Rhys-Jones has branched out. He's become a very familiar TV presenter and prominent in what you might call conservation-related causes. He led a demonstration at Cambridge University protesting its intention to drop its degree in architecture. He starred in the BBC's Three Men in a Boat series alongside another recent guest of ours, Dara O'Brien. And for the documentary series Mountain, he climbed 15 British peaks. Then there was Greatest Cities of the World. He's become a great traveller. Now there's Griff's great Kiwi road trip, which starts on Prime this coming week, I think, in which he tries to find out what it means to be a New Zealander in 2019. Griff Rhys-Jones, hello.
Hello to you, Jim. How are you?
Lovely to talk to you.
And you.
What is it with UK comedians and travel shows, please? Stephen Fry, Michael Palin, Billy Connolly, Griff Rhys-Jones.
Well, when I first got invited to do travel shows, there was a real dilemma. I went to see people at the BBC and they said, we don't need to do travel shows, Griff, but unfortunately, we've got Michael Palin doing them. And that's how they only had Michael Palin, and it was considered sort of slightly naughty to go into to venture out into the world. I'd said, oh, so I'd love to do a journey in South. No, Michael's going. Michael is going to South America. He's got it on his list. Oh, right. Well, I was thinking it would be nice to sort of travel out to Australia. No, I'm afraid Michael wants to go to Australia. So there was a sort of huge list of... And then, eventually, it was sort of divided up. Remember the Pope said, you know, you, Spain, can have half the world, you, Portugal, have the other half. We were sort of divided up, and I was given Cheltenham, I think. And... They said to me a long time ago, they said, Griff, we've got this great idea. We're going to do a programme exploring Britain's wide open spaces. And I said, okay, that suits me. And they said, you know, and you're going up to the all the highest places in Britain. And I said, is it going to be called In Search of Broadband? And they said, no, it's going to be called Mountain. And so I said, I said at the time that I didn't know anything about mountains, but mountains was very confusing for me. I'd never been mountaineering. They said, that's terrific. We want you to be a virgin mountaineer. I said, right, and what if I fall off? And he said, well, if you could fall off, that would be even better. So I knew from the very start that all my journeys, I'd have to have a little sort of niche, which would be entirely my own. And most of that is lowering me off things and trying to make me do things, which sound a little bit more frightening than I should be doing.
The niche would be entirely your own, but you'd be on your own if you fell off a mountain.
Possibly. Yeah. I don't know. A lot of people standing around looking at me,
right,
going, come on, can you do that again, Griff? One of the most terrifying things I've done was to cross a sort of treetop sort of course, balancing, where you went from a tyre to or along a slack wire and things like that.
Yeah.
They got to a point which is called a sort of parachute drop. And what they did was they tied a wire behind you, put you on a sort of platform 60 foot up and said, jump. And I did, I have to say, I thought I'd never get off that platform. If the camera hadn't been running
and
the director yelling at me, go on, jump, jump, Griff, jump, I'd never have gone. It was the most terrifying thing I ever did. And I remember I jumped off. And the point is that they train parachuters to do this so that as you drop, the idea is that it sort of, you know, it slows you down until you jump, until you hit the ground exactly as if you'd jumped with a parachute. I had no idea when I hit the ground that parachutists landed on the ground quite so quickly.
I
thought it would slow me down more. It didn't. Bang! And then the director said, that was great, can we do it again? And, you know, it was just terrible.
I don't know if we've got those tree walks in New Zealand, but I've never struck one with a parachute drop. That sounds a bit scary, actually. It does sound
scary. It was a little bit scary. But I've done more scary things since I've been engaged on this extraordinary journey at the moment.
As you say, you take a camera around with you, so you have to do these things. But you are intrepid. But the other point is that you, and I'll get to the intrepid stuff, but you're also funny, which was the point of my first question. And I imagine that poor old Alan Wicker or Johnny Morris wouldn't get a look in these days on television travelogues.
I think Alan Wicker was a very funny man.
He was
And if you remember, he started, before he did his Wicker's World, by doing really dry, sort of dryly funny sort of pieces, reports into a thing called The Tonight Show. And he was absolutely brilliant at doing it. And you see early Alan Wicker, and you do think he was a very, very clever. And I don't, to be honest, Michael has sort of such charm. The thing that's really interesting is that the original programme, Round the World in 80 Days, which made Michael's sort of name, was originally slated for Noel Edmonds. And they couldn't get Noel to do it. So Michael was a replacement.
I didn't know
and
that.
He was triumphant in it, wasn't he?
Although not as triumphant as your good self, who goes to the places he doesn't go to.
I want to hear more of this. Come on, let's keep it going, Jim.
Okay.
Keep it going, yeah.
People, I suppose the mission has changed. You've got to do the parachute drops and the skydiving because people travel more. They can see so much more on YouTube. But you seem to have got around that in places like Africa by full immersion and by finding, you know, really out of the way aspects of local life. Is it hard to discover those? Because I suppose you have to work harder.
My job, as I do it partly, is often to stop and often to say, film this. Because sometimes, you know, there's a schedule and an idea of a thing that's going to happen and a contributor lined up. But actually, the funniest thing that happens is just, I was once in Africa and the train, I've never done this before, the train was 24 hours late. That's not bad, is it? So we had to wait for 24 hours for this train in Tanzania. There'd been a strike and things like that. And when we got to the station, all the people saw the camera and the television and they came over and they protested. They wanted to talk to the camera and to me and to make sure that their point was made is that they were dependent on this train to run their business. It kept their supplies coming. And I thought this was wonderful. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah,
I thought this was sort of like the truth. And sometimes I have to say to people I'm working with, especially new people I'm working with, we're going to get a lot of fun out of the truth, actually. So don't worry too much about contrivance or setting things up. We have to have things to do, but when we do them, we will often find that things being true are quite, you know, they make people feel that it's a real journey because it sort of is.
Griff Rhys-Jones is with us. Griff's Great Kiwi Road Trip. So you are touring New Zealand from top to bottom for the Great Kiwi Road Trip. So the normal questions, sir, what are the highlights so far?
I was invited to, in the north, to visit Amarai and to be greeted there. And that's the sort of thing, in the funniest way, you only see it when, you know, Harry and Meghan do it and they're given feathered cloaks and all that stuff on television. But when it actually happens to you, it's a very moving experience. Mm. We all have our ceremonies and processes of welcome, even if it's only, you know, come in, take your shoes off. But, you know, this was something that was quite fascinating because it took you to a world in which welcome, greeting, association and kai, and they were all part of life, you know, and that was a fascinating thing to do.
Yes, I saw that on your schedule and I knew it would be notable for you. Well, actually, speaking of your schedule, It looks relentless. Is that the way you like to roll? That's your hustle? That you prefer it that way?
We We are a little bit. I mean, once you get up and running, you do run. We've sort of determined not to go down State Highway 1. But you know, my biggest sensation is to be flying over from Auckland out towards Coromandel. And going out there, I've made it all more romantic than it actually is. It's Coromandel, isn't it? But a Coromandel.
Yes, but it did sound nice when you said it.
It sounded nice. Yeah. So one of the things about going out there is you pass over the most exquisite landscape. It's a very sunny day, so it must have been a bit of an anomaly. I got this terrible urge to linger. You know, that one of the problems with the television programme is you're pressing on, pressing on, yeah. pressing on. And I keep, and the same with the Bay of Islands. I sort of thought, I can't do this. I need to be here for about a week to explore this region. So it is always a disappointment that there's sort of pressure to keep going. And you think, well, this is something that only television can do for us and can get me to the high table every time. And that is better than being a tourist.
It gives you those lovely entrees, but, you know, you can't stay for the main course and dessert.
Yeah, well, that's possibly true.
The Coromandel is certainly delightful, and you got up on the foils on Auckland Harbour. By and large, though, are we a tame country to tour? How would you describe us?
Are you a lovely country to tour? Because New Zealanders are charming people. Really, really nice. If people say... if people say to you, you know, can I help you? They sort of mean it mm-hmm. in a shop. If people say it in Britain, can I help you? They mean, what on earth do you want? What are you doing here?
Can you hurry up?
And, yeah. And so, you know, that aspect of it is absolutely delightful. The scenery, partly what makes New Zealand so beautiful, has been the good fortune to be over two huge tectonic plates smashing together. And that's created this extraordinary landscape which we've been travelling through. So my next challenge is possibly to find out really what the New Zealand character is, as defined by this sort of sense of, you know, what makes people so charming? What makes them so hardy? And, you know, I was on a website with reading the other day about people from California complaining about coming to New Zealand, that it wasn't actually, hadn't turned out to be paradise. And the thing is that it was because they didn't feel they were earning enough money or doing little enough. Yeah. And in a way, most New Zealanders, I think, would say, but that's what our life is like. You know, we've chosen to live in this place, and it's there's an element of making do still about the philosophy of being a New Zealander. Do you think that's true?
I think there is a residual element of it, yeah. Yeah. I think a lot of it's disappeared, probably, because we've cosmopolitanised and softened up like the rest of the Western world. But, you know, it's still here.
It's still part of what deeply New Zealanders want you to buy into.
Yeah. That's true.
And that it's what people want you to buy into that defines, you know, their thing. In a funny sort of way, I always think the Brits want you to buy into their sense of humour. You know, they like the idea of being, if you come to Britain, don't take yourself too seriously, you know. They would love to feel that. I remember when I went travelling in Scandinavia, and I travelled from Germany, where the issue is really that Germans can take themselves quite seriously. Mm. Over to Denmark, and when we arrived in the first Danish area and started hanging around in pubs, we suddenly thought, oh, this is why the Danes and the Brits have such an affinity, is to do with the fact that they find things funny, you know. They laugh at themselves. So I think, you know, and that's, funny enough, that's great. That's what the New Zealanders have as well. It's quite interesting, I found, what New Zealanders are quite touchy about. They're extremely proud of their country and its achievements, and you have to be careful if you mention rugby, you know, but otherwise I think that we do share a sense of humour, and there's a charm about New Zealand and New Zealand people which is unbeatable.
We take that beauty for granted, of course, and you're someone who has seen, you know, the majesty of the Norwegian fjords or the sheer prettiness of the British countryside. And it probably surprises us slightly that the rest of the world thinks we're utterly gorgeous. But it doesn't surprise you as an outsider. I know you were here recently and you're not a stranger to the place, but we have something different.
I have to say that the funniest thing about doing this programme is the way I have to urge my fellow, you know, conspirators, to shoot more of the beautiful countryside that we're going through. We're going through Blissiff, and I'm going, wow, look at this, look at this. And I can see they're thinking, what's the matter with him? And it is partly the fact that, you know, really, you do live in an extraordinarily beautiful... And I came to New Zealand first in 1985. In those days, you know, when we toured, it's very difficult to do much more because of the nature of the sort of thing we were doing than explore the interior of your hotel room and the minibar and then get on a plane and fly on to the next place. It wasn't until after my last tour I'd put in a week in Queenstown and Wanaka and I was just sort of completely knocked out by it.
Griffrey Jones is with us. You had fish and chips with comedian Ben Hurley in Devonport. You would have to concede, I think, that British fish and chips are woeful compared with the
Wait just now. Hold on just a minute. You can get superb fish and chips in Britain, of course, but what's great down here, I discovered in Devonport, is, and it was delicious, is, of course, you've got this lovely fish. Lovely fresh fish.
That's right.
It was delicious. It was, I mean, in fact, I felt like Jamie Oliver, you know, trying to get passers-by to eat the fish and chips with me. It was so delicious.
You've
it
only
was,
got an old haddock and mackerel and stuff up there, haven't you?
Well, it's a little bit. I wouldn't be surprised if half the fish we're eating is deep frozen and comes from round here somewhere.
That's probably right. You've spent a bit of time on the water, because you, including some fishing in the Bay of Islands, and I know you owned a classic yacht, Argyle. What was the name? It's at some point.
Yes, I still do. I still don't know whether I can continue. I mean, I seem to be spending more and more time over here. I'm having to loan it to people to sail it in order to keep it sort of active while I'm away. I do adore boats, and I do try to spend a bit of time exploring. Yeah, and I've always wanted... when I did Three Men in a Boat, which I think you saw earlier here, with Dara and Rory, and I was the sort of boating person, and those two were sort of grumpy about boats, and that worked really well. And I love that, and I'm not sure why the BBC decided, oh, we don't want it. But they've never had much sympathy for boating, the truth be known, television companies. They find that they worry that their equipment will get wet. And so, I think, so all us boaty people fight a losing battle to persuade people in television that the things that are great about sailing, not really racing, although I love racing myself, not watching boats race, which is the equivalent to watching snails race, you know. It's really sort of like, it's really about living on board boats and enjoying boats and using boats to get to places.
And you're the country that gave us Swallows and Amazons. That's the thing.
And I was brought up with those books, you know, so I have made programmes about Arthur Ransome. And I've always wanted to make a film about Arthur Ransome and the fact that he covered the Russian Revolution.
Yes, he was fascinating, Ransome.
He was, yes. Mm.
But we're talking about you, and I understand you've put an offer in on Pakatoa Island.
I went to have a look at Pakatoa Island, and I just thought, I mean, personally, I'm not an island person. I'm always jumping, you know, as soon as I have a gap or a break, I'm always jumping on and moving on to the next place. And an island wouldn't suit me, to be honest.
Okay.
It's a lovely island, though.
No, well, you probably get it cheaply, but don't let me try and persuade you. You see, you've done kind of interesting things here. You've walked down Queen Street. Now, your goal in this series, along with taking in the sights, is to discover what it means, I think this is it, to what it means to be a New Zealander today.
Yes.
So how have you been doing this, and any conclusions, are there any conclusions forming?
Well, along the way, I've been fascinated, really, by the fact that New Zealand, especially if you look down from the Sky Tower and you see the enormous stretch of Auckland, and you think there's a sort of new New Zealand, because New Zealand used to be associated, I think, with the rural community, with sheep and now increasingly dairy and so on. But that's now, it used to be, didn't it, 30 sheep per person, and now it's down to 7 sheep, I believe, a person. So the whole nature of New Zealand is changing as lots of people come in from different places. And finding the new New Zealand, which is a cosmopolitan and self-confident place,
That's why I found fish and chips quite funny. Because I come to New Zealand, the food is incredible, you know, people. And actually, funnily enough, going to somewhere like Gibbs Farm and seeing really extraordinary world-beating sculpture, you know, arranged like that, it's like going to, if you like, something organised by the new Medicis. You know, it's like something seeing, and it's a destination in itself. And so I think there was probably a time, 50 years ago, when New Zealanders would think, oh, I want to go and see what happens in Europe. And increasingly, people in Europe want to go and see what's happening in New Zealand.
Couple more things. You said once, as a child, you go out and play and you lose all track of time and space. Mm. It's harder and harder to attain that blissful state of absorption as you get older. I did a 6-month sailing trip to St. Petersburg with some mates just to get it back. So are you like the rest of us most of the time? You're constantly connected. You're feeling the texts and the calls. Do you carve out mindfulness for yourself personally?
My mindfulness.
Well, really, you know, or the equivalent of.
Yes,
space.
I think it comes. It seriously comes, sitting at the helm of a boat, any boat actually, and seeing a distant island, and then just spending, you know, a couple of hours just sailing her. It's because you leave the world that you've been in, and you enter immediately a different world. Mm. But it's not a world without consequence or involvement or active participation. It's sort of it's a complete escape. So I'm afraid this is the terrible thing about me, and I slightly regret it. I am somebody who really loves. I'm greedy for experience. I spend more and more time in art galleries these days and look at pictures for an after. And it's terrible. I find myself spending longer and longer looking at good pictures. I loved being in South Australia and visiting the South Australia. I had just a day off, went for the afternoon to the South Australian Art Gallery. I love the art gallery in Auckland. It's great interest to me.
OK. So a question off the back of that. What would you have done, do you think, if you'd got on stage early in your life and no one had found you funny or charming enough? What would you be now?
Teacher.
A teacher?
Probably.
Because of the need to entertain and communicate.
I'd probably have been a director behind the scenes, because that's what I, when I was at university, I did. I mostly directed plays. I was a bit of a sort of tyro figure, undergraduate figure, a BNOC, big on campus. And I was... I was sort of somebody who sort of went around and ran all the societies and things like that. But we were very self-absorbed as a group of people at university. And so we didn't, in those days, in the early 70s, we didn't think, what are we going to do afterwards? We were also hippies. So we sort of thought, ooh, everything will work out and I'll end up in a cornfield staring at the sun. But and I've sort of done that. But and so I didn't know what I was doing. I was doing arts because they told us to go to university, and that's what we did. And so everything that happened after that was just sort of stumbling along. Mm. And I was really full of admiration for people who knew that they wanted to be lawyers, or my family was a medical family, so I should have really become a doctor, but I wasn't good enough at science, things like that, at school, so there was no chance of that. So I found myself instead sort of being involved in history. And I don't know, I'd probably found a job. I worked as a producer in the BBC, Radio, when I left, and I'd be there still probably if I hadn't moved off to work in Not the 9 o'clock News.
A lot of us know the stumbling along career path. I just want to ask you one more thing. You once quoted Confucius when asked about your attitude to travel. Wherever you go, go with all your heart. Which is lovely. But, of course, that doesn't extend to shabby airports and long-haul flights and so on. So are there aspects of being here that you don't like, to be completely honest? What's the worst part of all the travel?
Well, What would I say? I don't know. For me, and this is complicated, the worst part of the travel is, you know, you get to a hotel, you try to get yourself settled in the room, and then you're literally leaving at 6 the following morning. So even just the act of unpacking what you have with you to go to bed makes you frustrated, because you know that the more you get out of that bag, instead of just lying in your kit on the bed and sort of stepping straight up, and you can't do that. You've got to brush your teeth and all that, so you know, oh God, we'll leave it at 6 tomorrow. That means I've got to get up at 5:15 because I've got to pack everything away again. That I'm getting out now, but I've got to get to bed. So that's the only thing. That is the aspect of this particular travel that sometimes, but not always. It's simply not true that it's like that all the time.
We'll be very interested to see what you think of us. And it's, I think we've always been very fond of you, Griff Rees-Jones. So thank you for coming over, and good luck with the rest of your travels.
Well, it's a joy and a privilege.
Griff Rees-Jones.